The next case is 07954 and 1176, Elizabeth Burnett versus Motorist Mutual Insurance Companies. Mr. Strapp.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Attorney Jude Streb on behalf of Defendant Appellant Motorist Mutual Insurance Company. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In this case, the appellee, Mrs. Burnett, was injured in a motor vehicle accident caused by the negligence of her husband, Mr. Burnett, and is currently attempting to recover under the uninsured motorist coverage portion of her policy with Motorist Mutual Insurance Company. Motorists denied coverage to Mrs. Burnett based upon an intra-family exclusion in the policy, which very closely tracks the language in Revised Code Section 3937.18K2, which is at issue in the case today. The issue before the case specifically is whether former Revised Code Section 3937.18K2, when read in conjunction with Section K1, violates the equal protection clauses of the Ohio or United States constitutions, since it creates an arbitrary and illogical classification of individuals based on household status that has disparate and unfair effect, since it precludes coverage for injured individuals solely because they are related to or live in the household of the insured. It is appellant's position that former Section 3937.18K2 does not violate the equal protection clauses because it does not create any classification of individuals such that an equal protection violation is possible. Further, even assuming, for the sake of argument, that a classification of individuals is created, Section K2 passes the rational basis test in that it is rationally related to a legitimate government interest and, as a result, does not violate the equal protection clause.
What would that interest be?
That interest has been identified in numerous cases as the prevention of fraudulent or collusive lawsuits among family members.
So you actually believe, yeah, I've heard that justification over the years and maybe not thought that much about it until I see a case here where a court says this is a denial of equal protection. So you actually believe that people would go out and get themselves in car wrecks, risking injury, the driver would do this, risking injury to him or herself, so that a family member living in their household could collect a fraudulent claim?
Your Honor, I believe that...
Do you really believe that?
I believe that it is possible.
Well, anything is possible. But do you think that happens in our society as a matter of course, a matter of routine?
I think it does happen, and I also believe that the...
Really?
I believe it has happened, yes, and I believe that the case law also states in Ohio that whether or not it happens, whether or not there is evidence or empirical data to support it, is irrelevant to whether or not an equal protection violation is possible.
Okay, so as a result of that fear of unknown and unproven, you don't know of any case where that's been proven, do you?
I do not, Your Honor.
Okay. As a result of that unknown and unproven fear of fraud, that someone would go out and get themselves in a car wreck, risking injury to themselves so that their child or spouse could make a fraudulent claim against their insurance policy, it's okay to have policies that leave the people that are most dear to us, family members, uncovered in terms of insurance, right? MedPay is all they can get. Isn't that your position?
I believe that is what...
That's the way your policy works. I shouldn't say your position. That's the way your client's policy works.
That is correct, Your Honor.
They can never recover on a liability claim, and they cannot recover on an uninsured or underinsured motorist claim. So a prudent person who wants to protect themselves from all, claims of other people that they injure through their mistakes in other cars, or so you cause an accident. You can protect everybody but the people most dear to you.
Well, Your Honor, yes.
And that's a rational basis.
That is what the policy states, Your Honor, but more specifically.
Well, is that a rational distinction?
I believe it is, yes. And as I stated, that is what the policy states, but more.
I know that's what it says, but you've been met with an equal protection challenge here. The Court of Appeals says it defies equal protection.
Correct.
And your answer is this fear of an unknown and unproven fraud makes it rational to exclude for every policyholder of your company coverage for the family members that the person who buys the policy would hold most dear.
That's not precisely the argument. My first argument is that no classification of individuals is created by the statute such that an equal protection violation is even possible. You have to assume that a classification is created to even get to a rational basis analysis of this case. And so, as I stated before, I don't think an equal protection analysis is prudent because there is no classification here. The statute very specifically defines uninsured and underinsured motor vehicles and has nothing to do with individuals, and that's a conclusion this Court reached in the Kyle versus Buckeye Union case in 2004.
If there's a classification, it's a classification of motor vehicles, I think. Is that your argument?
That is the argument.
People. And
it's a classification of motor vehicles, yes, Your Honor. And that holding was supported by the Morris case in the Fourth District, with which this case is presently in conflict. And that the court in Morris relied heavily on this court's opinion in Kyle that Section K-2 addresses tortfeasors' vehicles and not the individuals themselves.
Counsel, I wonder if I could ask just a little more of a background question on these inter-family exclusions. And I understand this one arises on the statute that permits, that's an exception to the minimum coverage that's required under statute for UIM coverage. Is that correct?
That K-2 permits that exclusion? I would say that at the time when K-2 was in effect, it didn't only permit the exclusion, it mandated the exclusion because it was a statutory definition of underinsured and uninsured motor vehicles, and it excluded from that definition any vehicle that was owned by, furnished to, or being operated by a named insured, a spouse or resident relative of a named insured. It just so happens that most policies contained an intrafamily exclusion that was nearly identical to the language in Section K-2.
All right, so your argument is that the statute mandates the exclusion. It's not simply permitted. So does that mean then that it is impossible for any individual to purchase uninsured motorist coverage for their family members that are in the same vehicle when an accident occurs, even for an additional premium?
At that time, yes, Your Honor. So long as they were in a vehicle that was owned by, furnished to, or available for the regular use of a named insured. If, for example, they were driving a vehicle owned by a friend, then depending on the terms of the policy, that coverage could be provided.
All right, thanks.
I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, please.
Thank you, Mr. Streb. Mr. Vismick.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Robert Vismick, and I represent the appellee in this matter, Elizabeth Burnett. Factually, opposing counsel is 100% right. Ms. Burnett is in a vehicle owned and operated by her husband. And that vehicle is named under the policy. And they, in fact, purchased U-coverage, uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage. The exclusions in that case were both under the liability policy and under the uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage. Motorist excludes bodily injury under the liability portion for injuries that occur to a family member, and further, they provide this K2 exclusion, which limits recovery when you are injured by a vehicle that is owned or being operated by a resident relative. The argument that I see from the briefs that they are hanging their hat on is simply that no classification exists. And I think to look at several hypotheticals, we will be able to determine both under my theory and even under appellant's counsel theory that certainly even his brief indicates that classifications exist. The first way we can look at it is let's take our facts and add an individual to the vehicle. If the neighbor of Mrs. Burnett was also in that vehicle to the soccer game they were going to, let's say, the policy would certainly, under the terms, forbid Ms. Burnett to recover under the liability portion because of this intrafamily exclusion, which is also contained in the liability portion, which also is not a part of this appeal. Secondly, she would be precluded because the vehicle that the tortfeasor was operating was owned by a resident relative, named insured. Both fit the bill in this particular case, which be her husband. Appellant counsel argues, well, certainly in that case, the neighbor is also actually, under the terms of the Burnett policy, the neighbor is also injured in a vehicle that is owned by or being operated, named insured. So they argue, well, they're going to be denied under the U coverage as well. Well, yes and no. Let's take a step back from that, that argument and look at the practical effect of this. Practically speaking, that neighbor is going to recover under the liability portion. They're going to receive, if injuries warrant, and in this particular case, we have $100,000, $300 policy, both under the liability and U coverage as they're equal. If her injuries warranted it, she would receive the full $100,000 under the liability portion, and then by statute and just in the way we know insurance law to work, she's not going to be permitted to go under the U coverage anyway. And we can change the facts even a little bit differently in this particular case. Let's assume for a moment that the neighbor has her own vehicle that's parked in her garage that on this particular day she doesn't want to drive. The policy that she has is identical to, in fact, let's assume she insures with motorists as well. The policy contains both the liability intrafamily exclusion and it contains both the intrafamily exclusion in accordance with K2 under the U coverage. Now let's go back to our fact pattern where Mr. Burnett is again injured. We've gone through it before and we know that under the policy, Ms. Burnett, the wife, is not going to be able to recover. The vehicle that the tortfeasor is operating is owned, being operated by a spouse, resident, relative, named insured, however you want to get to that point, she's going to be excluded. But now the neighbor, she's going to have coverage, assuming her injuries exceed the liability portions under the Burnett policy. She is welcome to go after U coverage under her own motorist policy, which is identical to the Burnett policy. And the reason being, the vehicle that her policy says the same thing, that injured you was owned or operated by a named insured. And in that particular case, none of the named insureds under the neighbor's policy is the owner of the vehicle that injured her.
Counsel, is there any other state that has found the intrafamily exclusion unconstitutional?
Let me first say that I am, unfortunately, I'm a little nervous and I'm drawing a blank. I know that there are jurisdictions out there, and I apologize that I do not recall them at this point.
Are they in your brief?
They may or may not be. I'm not certain. In fact, if I had to say, I would say no, they are not. But
you believe that there is another state court, Supreme Court, that has found the intrafamily exclusion, which pretty much exists nationwide, to be unconstitutional?
Yes. Yes. Going back to kind of a response to counsel's, he says, well, there's this Kyle case. We're not here today to tell you let's reject the Kyle case. No, the Kyle case is accurate. K2 clearly says an uninsured motor vehicle is not. It certainly defines what an uninsured motor vehicle is or isn't, but it defines it by the owner of the vehicle. It defines it by the operator of the vehicle. I think that an applicable case is a United States Department of Agriculture versus Moreno. And as the justices may likely know, that case dealt with a food stamp statute. And in that particular case, the statute defined what a household was for purposes of the statute. Same way this case defines what an uninsured vehicle is. And in Moreno, the definition of a household was based on the individuals residing in it. And in that particular case, the statute, in a nutshell, said that you were not considered a household for purposes of obtaining food stamps if you were not related to all of the other individuals residing in the home. An equal protection challenge was waged against that under the similar circumstances as we have here. In that case, they said the classification was very generally one class is individuals that were living with only their relatives, and the other class was individuals that were living with people other than their relatives. In that particular case, they argued that the governmental interest, and mind you, this is also a rational basis examination was being conducted in this case, that the interest was, one, nutrition. It had something to do with we want to promote nutrition amongst individuals in our country, and the second is to prevent fraud, fraudulent food stamp claims. In that particular case, the holding was clear that it didn't make sense. There was no reason that individuals who were not related would be more likely to put fraudulent claims forward than individuals that were related. And if you want to take that application to our case, you can certainly find another class. And the class that could also be delineated by the statute is written into the statute. Counsel says in this situation, yes, if you want to look strictly at that particular statute, he's true. Both individuals riding in that vehicle look to be excluded. Although I think the exclusion is due to the fact they're going to receive liability insurance, if we want to separate ourselves from that, it does seem that the statute would exclude it to everybody residing in the car.
Counsel, but isn't this more of a question of the structure of the world of insurance, automobile insurance, which certainly insurance companies will insure for anything for the right price. And if it is deemed appropriate, or if there were a statute in place saying that there's no longer an intrafamily exclusion, then the insurance company would have to reinvent itself, the insurance world, reinvent itself, offer this or this type of coverage, and then charge accordingly. There's nothing to preclude that. Am I correct?
Well, at the time, as counsel suggested, you didn't have the option.
I understand that, but I'm telling you, they didn't have the option because that wasn't available across the board from insurance carriers. However, if that's the structure of the way the insurance industry does business. It's a business. They're not providing food stamps for somebody's nutrition, which is a policy in a governmental operation or responsibility. This is a business, and if it's not profitable or it's not meeting their business model across the state or across the country, then they're not offering this kind of insurance coverage. If it would be, or if there were states that mandated this through statutes, which is a legislative requirement, then they would offer it and they would charge accordingly. But to claim that there's some kind of right here to this kind of coverage that, number one, wasn't figured, wasn't bargained for, and wasn't paid for, I think I have a problem with that.
Well, to answer your question in one particular way, it's I know my policy is thick, and I'm not saying it's not my obligation. It certainly is to read that policy, but under the J1 provision, which is loosely a part of this, there's an obligation to announce to your insurance company, this vehicle, I want uninsured motorist coverage for this particular vehicle. Certainly, that, and that's the basis of the Kyle opinion, where at that point then the K2 provision seems to remove that coverage from it. But I think we're straying away from the fact that this is a statute passed by the legislature which prohibits this sort of coverage. We have the state action here that mandates this, thus throwing us into this equal protection analysis. Firstly, whether there is a classification, and second, whether it survives that rational basis.
So it's your interpretation as well that this statute prohibits insurance companies from issuing interfamily coverage, even if the insured wants it and is willing to pay an extra premium for it?
I would say yes. I mean, it defines by statute what an uninsured motorist vehicle is. I mean, there is no provision
but
that
the statute is something that is a minimum minimum mandatory offering. So this is an exception from the minimum mandatory offering, which seems to me to be more of a permissive matter than a mandatory matter.
Well, I mean, even if the problem is I'd be standing here and telling you something that I necessarily don't have evidence of. And certainly if a premium was available, you know, I can't say whether Ms. Burnett would or would not want that. I would venture to say that insurance companies would not permit such a thing because of their
concern.
Well,
counsel, in these jurisdictions where you claim that there has been a declaration of unconstitutionality, is this coverage awarded or available in those jurisdictions?
I do not know.
And you don't know the jurisdictions that where this the states that have declared this unconstitutional?
No, unfortunately, I do not.
And the basis of the unconstitutionality in those jurisdictions is denial of equal protection? Is
that? I wouldn't want to get out on a limb and say that. No, I'm unsure of that. But I will say under the facts and the statute in this particular case that it certainly violates equal protection.
Well, let me move then to the issue which you have talked about in your brief, and that is if it does set up a classification that there's no rational basis for it, and we've already had a discussion this morning about coverage for family members. And I think your argument in the brief is that, as has been suggested, that it is irrational to take away coverage from those individuals you probably most likely want to coverage. But let's look at it in a different way. If the one of the rational basis is that there is a greater likelihood of fraud or collusive claims among family members, unlike the example, somebody goes out and deliberately has an automobile accident so they can cover damage. But let's say you have an automobile accident, the spouse is in the car and claims injury. Isn't that much more likely to be a collusive sort of thing than if a neighbor is in the car? Because if the neighbor's in the car, then you have to sue the driver so you have a competitive relationship. But if it's a family member, there is no competitive relationship, and the likelihood of collusion is greater. Not that there is collusion, but the likelihood or the possibility of it is greater. Now, wouldn't that be a rational basis?
Well, I disagree. I just don't think there's any
reason to believe that a neighbor whom you may or may not be close with is any less likely to or more likely to collude than your spouse. I mean, we have to...
Not more likely, less likely.
So, right, I don't think there's
because
any difference.
Because there's a driver or the driver's insurance carrier in a competitive adversary relationship with the neighbor, but you certainly don't want to be with a spouse or a family member.
Well, I mean, I think in this particular case, whether we consider it adversarial or not, Ms. Burnett's claim would be against her husband. And whether we believe that that's adversarial...
And do you think the husband would fight that?
Well, I wouldn't say he would fight it, but he would be likely, if it got to the point of litigation and it was Burnett versus Burnett, he would be assigned counsel by motorists, and it would be defended accordingly. So I would think that he would, in fact, fulfill his obligation. I don't think he would lie under any circumstance.
Okay.
And the insurance company is more than welcome to defend such a claim on the basis of collusion. They're not foreclosed from doing so. But we have to look at the statute as a whole and understand that it provides for what seems like a bit of an unreasonable situation where a mother would prefer her neighbor to drive her child to school rather than herself, because the child and the mother are for some reason more likely to collude. But in the situation where the neighbor child is driving with the mother's child is driving with a neighbor and the injury is warranted, she would have U coverage under this same motorist policy.
Counsel, I've always been mystified by the notion of collusion. I assume the collusion is not going to be about the question that the accident happened, because that's pretty provable.
Certainly.
Either there was or there wasn't an accident. So the collusion is going to be about the nature of the injuries.
I believe it's a question of damages.
And there, the driver is not going to be testifying other than loss of consortium or, you know, how much they had to help around the house in the case of a spouse. Or
certainly competent medical testimony would be implemented in order to prove the medical claim and medical portion of it. And now, if that also includes collusion on their parts, that's a wholly separate issue.
Okay. So, but the collusion, if any, that this provision is supposedly worrying about would be in the medical claim.
Well,
it's hard to imagine collusion about the
to sit here and say it's
happened.
Unreasonable or impossible for that to happen. I assume it's possible that they could, well, now that I'm thinking about it, I've not thought of this before, but certainly you need independent corroborative evidence in order for that ghost phantom vehicle to cause it. So it seems like the only likelihood that the fraudulent or collusive claim would go to a damages portion of the claim, because there would either be independent corroborative evidence to indicate that an impact did occur in the motor vehicle, or the motor vehicle was actually visibly damaged or hit the tree or whatever it is, or rear-ended someone else.
You've used your time, Mr. Bismig.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Shreve, you've saved 6 minutes of your time.
Counsel, I've looked through the briefs of the opposing counsel and the amicus, and I don't find any citation to any other state. So I ask you the same question. Are you aware of any other state that has declared this to be unconstitutional as violative of due?
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
Counsel, are you aware of other states that had this was a gap for 3 years, right?
Correct, approximately 3 years.
Are you aware of other states that created such a gap or permitted statutorily such a gap for their citizens where there was mandatory offering of under and uninsured motorist coverage, which we don't have now?
No, Your Honor, I'm not aware of that.
Will we find in the record, I assume from your previous answers will we find in the record any evidence or information indicating the frequency, if any, of collusive conduct among family members in auto accidents?
No, Your Honor, there's no evidence of that in the record. And as I stated previously, I don't believe that evidence or empirical data supporting fraud or collusion is relevant in an equal protection analysis.
Was that issue raised at trial?
This case did not go to trial, Your Honor. It was decided on summary judgment.
Okay, so there's been no opportunity to present any evidence either way on that issue at this point, because the Court of Appeals didn't take any evidence, I assume.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, if it's true that the General Assembly, I think you both agree that the statute prohibited during this period of time, prohibited these exclusions for interfamily coverage, there has to be some basis upon which the General Assembly enacted the legislation. And in other cases, we've looked to testimony, evidence offered before legislative committees regarding the crisis or the problem that was being addressed by the legislation. I take it that you're saying, again, there's none of that here. So we have to just sort of assume that maybe common sense says that there could be collusion among family members. It could go to the nature of the accident, it seems to me, too. That was sort of a throwaway, but it seems to me you could have a dispute about who caused the accident. And a husband and wife in the same car might have the same view of who caused the accident. But we leave it to sort of common sense, I guess, that you're asking us to do that, to leave it to common sense that there could be collusion among family members where the driver of the car is a tortfeasor. Am I correct in assuming that, or we have nothing else, I guess, do we?
Correct, Your Honor. There is no evidence I'm aware of in any of the cases I reviewed of fraud or collusion. However, there are a number of cases where this court has looked at that possibility. There was the State Farm versus Alexander case, Dairyland versus Finch, and a case which Mr. Vismeg brought up and which is in our reply brief, which relates to the corroborative evidence rule for the phantom vehicle situation where someone claims that they were injured by the negligence of an unidentified vehicle and attempts then to recover under the uninsured portion of their vehicle. And the rationale behind the corroborative evidence rule of this court was eliminating the potential for fraud or collusion in those situations. So I'm not aware of evidence in any cases where fraud or collusion occurred, but that possibility has been considered by this court and other courts throughout Ohio many different times.
Counsel, the 11th District, in making its ruling, stated it disagreed with Kyle. If we were to affirm the 11th District, would we be impairing the vitality of the Kyle decision?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The issue in Kyle was whether those two subsections, K2 and J1, could essentially coexist, and I don't think that this would have any effect on that determination. The reason I think Kyle is relevant to this case is because in conducting that analysis in Kyle, this court looked very closely at what J1 and K2 cover. And with regards to K2, it specifically said that it relates to when a tortfeasor's vehicle will be considered uninsured or underinsured. So I don't think that saying that it defines, for example, when individuals can recover based upon the identity of the tortfeasor, that it would bring it into conflict with J1.
All right. So you're disagreeing with the 11th District, but you're not saying that they in any way affected our decision there?
I don't think so, no, Your Honor. I just think that case law and the principle of stare decisis require them to adopt this court's conclusion and reasoning in Kyle that K2 relates to vehicles and not individuals. And what they've done in their opinion, essentially, I think, is added an additional layer to an equal protection analysis. They have said that K2 classifies vehicles, and it's that classification that creates the classification of individuals that violates the equal protection clauses. So, again, I think that they have added an additional layer to that analysis, and that affirming that decision could have far-reaching implications on all types of equal protection challenges, not just challenges of this specific statute. And so I would ask the court to reverse the 11th District's opinion and to enter final judgment in favor of Motorist Mutual Insurance Company.
Thank you, Mr. Strebb.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
You may be seated.